This is the Financial Coconut Podcast, Singapore's first personal finance podcast network. I'm your host, Reggie, aka your chief financial coconut. Every Wednesday, you'll be chilling with me and my guests, who are some of the quirkiest, geekiest people we can find on the internet, about how they do money and life. Sit back, relax. We are a few days away from the weekend. Welcome to Chills with TFC.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
If you can produce a good piece of work that your readers would want to read, even though it's a branded content, that is typically something that is a win for the advertisers. But sometimes they don't see it that way because they want their marketing message to be in there. So that's the biggest challenge, is content strategizing on our end, where they might tell us, hey, they want this to be written in a certain way, and we say, no, that doesn't work. You try not to tell the advertisers straight in the face, but basically you want to tell them you'll fall flat. Right.
Welcome to Chills with TFC, where we sit down with the geekiest, quirkiest individuals to learn about how they do money and life. I'm your host, Reggie, aka your chief financial coconut. And finally, we have him on the show, right? Guy is like pre-Seedly, long ago, right? Ancient. He built and led quite a movement in the personal finance space. And for a period of time, you will see him host events and all that. But no more, because now got me, right? So after my appearance, it shall only be me. It's okay, you relax. But more importantly, after writing for 10 years, I think there's certain insights, and I would even say he has harnessed some revelations about the space, which he shared today, right? And I had to ask him this one question, which has been something that I've been asking different people, is what is one personal finance advice that aged really well for him? So feel free to guess what he shared. Introducing Timothy Ho from Dollars and Cents. This is Chills with TFC.
I try to not be so diplomatic also.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, just chat, right? Give some value to people listening.
Yeah. Hey, you know that one line just killed a lot of other people. I was trying to say that many other pieces of content that go out there, very diplomatic and don't really give value to people tuning in.
No lah, I'm sure there are people out there who do give value as well. Just maybe they sometimes scared to say the wrong thing.
Share me a little bit more, where's that coming from?
Nah, I mean, finance space, everyone always wants to say the right thing, right?
Well, so what does that mean? What does saying the right thing mean?
I think in the financial and the media space, and maybe even in the influencer space, actually now that I think about it, more with regards to lifestyle influencers, right? They want to present a certain type of narrative. Nothing wrong with that. I think that's just the branding that they're trying to create for themselves. But I think for us, it's, or like, at least for me, I think we should just be genuine, right? End of the day, if we're here to help people, and a lot of people do may look up to the kind of things we do as well. So I think it's important for us to just be transparent as much as possible. The only time I think it's better.
So when is it not possible?
I think you try not to be transparent when certain things are sensitive, right? Certain point of view that people, that we may have, is not something which everyone may agree with. I think that's the difference in personal finance sometimes that we have to...
Like what? Can you give me an example?
Okay, so for example, even if a simple topic like property, right? There are a lot of people who say you should stay in a HDB. There are others who believe that don't necessarily need to stay in a HDB. Like for me personally, we stay in a private property. We bought it last year. I wouldn't openly share unless someone asked me, but it's the reason it's more family related. I don't want to stay near my parents because I also have a special needs sister as well who stays with my parents. So if in the event when they're old, they need help, I need to be there as well. For HDB, it's quite difficult because basically, you only can own one HDB each. Right? And then my parents can't own a HDB because they also have multiple properties. So these kind of things, are stuff that maybe sometimes I don't share. Because not everyone, I mean, the people might portray it differently sometimes, right? Like, hey, this Dollars and Cents guy says that HDB is the way to go, best save you money, but he himself live in a private property.
I get it.
You should be ashamed of any decision you make, but there's a lot of different factors. Some of it is very personal to maybe the family or the circumstances they are in, right? So I think these kind of things sometimes, those are the way I try not to share too much, because I don't want to be seen as, I think the kind of influence we have, right? Sometimes people look at the things we do and take it as the benchmark of what is...
How it should be.
Correct, right? So for example, I don't share with people the kind of stocks I invest in. So that's quite different from some of the stock investment bloggers out there who like to tell you what they invest in. I am not a fan of that. Dinesh also not a fan of that, because we don't want to be seen as, hey, this dollars and cents founder, he invests in this kind of company.
Shilling.
And you know, we do lose money in some investments. I mean, obviously a lot of it is long-term anyway, but I think the key thing is not so much of like we embarrassed to say what we invest in, but neither are we trying to like tell everyone, hey, we invest in these companies as well, right? It's just something we prefer to keep personal, because we don't want it to be seen as us potentially promoting a stock, right? I think that's pretty much the norm, actually. If you look at a lot of people in the financial space,
most people don't.
People in senior positions, they don't share these things on, right? But yeah.
Some people will say, oh, if you don't share, then how can I trust your words?
That's exactly the key thing, right? Like, I think when it comes to the media space and the blogging space, right, there are a lot of bloggers who are very personal in their approach, right? So they will share with you what they will do. They will share with you the things they go for, the experience they have on certain products, right? For us at Dollars and Cents, we don't really do that as much. You know, we try to take a more neutral stance on any topic. So when we write about something, the whole idea is to provide a little bit of information in a way that's easily digestible. Probably not the only thing you need to know if you want to invest or consider a platform, but some of the basic information you need to have, right? So we try not to be, and I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. At the start, sometimes it could be seen as a bad thing. We try not to be too personal with...
Why is it a bad thing?
Because, to be honest, in the influencer space, this was all the way back in, like, I think when we first started out, 2012, 2013, right?
Senpai.
Yeah. A lot of the content was being created and probably do better when you take a personal approach towards the topic. And that is actually something we don't really actively do.
I would say you guys are not a blog, right? You're more like a news site, you know.
That's the funny thing. We're not a news site either, right? So if you come to Dollars and Cents Daily expecting us to recap the recent happening or what's happening, you don't see any of those things, right? We're not a news site either. But I think what we do is that a lot of the topics we write are... the closest example I can think of is more magazine style. So magazines tend to be topical, right? They're not really news, because obviously by the time the issue is out monthly, there's nothing newsy about it. But if you pick up a Men's Health, right? I mean, it's never news. Right? It's just about the topic that they cover, right? So I think that's just... For us, it's that way. Right? But that's it. I want to just share a little bit more, which is that I also tell people that we try to take a neutral stand. But it's not right to say we are unbiased. I don't want to like generalize to all journalism and writing and content creators, but it's impossible. It's very hard to not be biased from an individual perspective. All of us have perspective on a certain topic.
In journalistic school, they will talk about this whole idea of like objectivity, which is like a myth of objectivity,
right? You can try your best to be objective.
No, but on some level, it's a myth, right? Most people are biased depending on what you consume, what editorial do you publish, which house do you go under.
So what editorial you publish? So I always say people, right? The act of being, like for us in the editorial team currently, we are very into properties, right? So if you look at Dollars and Cents in general, and definitely in the last, you know, 1 year, because everyone is interested in properties, you see a lot more emphasis on property-related content. Okay, firstly, because people in Singapore are definitely interested to read more property content, but also because the editorial team collectively, we are interested in the topic. So it's very natural that we write more about it, right? But I think the kind of content we produce isn't a situation where, okay, so I think some of the individual bloggers may have a challenge where, you know, if they are younger and they haven't really bought their own house, it might be harder for them to write about property or why you should buy a HDB flat, because, you know, maybe they haven't bought a HDB flat. But I think as a collective team, and the fact that all of our content that we write isn't exactly about our, say, property purchasing experience, that allows us to take a more, you know, neutral stand on this topic. So you would see a topic like maybe step-by-step guide to understanding BTO grants in Singapore, right? So we don't need to have taken those grants to write a topic like that. There is pros and cons from a content creation point of view. Okay, I'll start with the cons first. The cons is that I think in general, personal experience type of content can fly better more easily. So if I share with you my terrible experience on renovating my HDB flat, I think it got a very good chance of going viral.
Clickbait, yes.
Right? I won't say clickbait lah. You know, clickbait is like when, you know, they promise you this, but then when you click the article, there's nothing.
Okay. But at least it baits you in. You come in.
Good angling. I think the kind of topics that could be a bit easy to go viral, you know, everyone can relate to a terrible renovation experience. But for us, we don't really do that kind of content. So that's just something we don't do as often. The good thing is that, especially when you have a collective team of writers, which is what we focus on, you can write more topics. Not everything has to be from a personal experience. You can do the research you need. You can go and find the information you need, and then you can write it in a way that's easily relatable.
So how do you then manage a situation where you may not agree with the editorial? So like from your own personal view, you don't agree, but the house view is this is what it is.
Okay, so a couple of things to note. Like, we don't exactly give a lot of opinions on topics. There are opinion pieces, don't get me wrong, but in general, we don't give a lot of views on, for example, okay, we might write an article about buying a private versus public housing, but then it could be like a pros and cons kind of things.
Which on some level has a view to it, right?
Which on some level has a view to it. So definitely whoever writes it would likely... Two things, right? Have to be somewhat knowledgeable on the topic. And then they may have some personal experience, right? So I think that is the part that I say is very hard to say you're completely unbiased.
Yeah, because you have your own worldview. You have your own basis of experience. Correct. And that taints all the things that you say.
So if you put a byline on an article, you need to be able to justify whatever you write. Obviously, as an editor, I think, or as an editorial team, we set certain guiding principles, right? So for example, we'll never recommend stocks, for example, because we can't, right? So those are guiding principles that guide it. We'll never deep dive into specific cryptocurrencies, right? Can call it a house view or the editorial view, right? But on individual writing level, obviously the writers is responsible for whatever they write. Information should be backed up with facts. It cannot just be an opinion. If you say that HDB prices in Singapore are very expensive, you're entitled to that point of view, but I need to see some form of, in comparison to maybe other countries, you know, maybe you bring up some stats that shows medium income versus average HDB price compared to other first world nation. And if it looks, Singapore does look a lot more expensive than other similar developed cities, then yes, that's okay to say. But you cannot just say it because you feel that is your thought process.
Right.
And
I would even argue to say that if you can take out median income relative to property prices, right, you're already quite sophisticated.
You should. I mean, if you have a strong view, you should have it, right? It can't just be a... I mean, look, if you want to write an article and you have strong views about that, you have to back up your point of view, right? Yeah. Mm. Otherwise, you know, don't exert that viewpoint.
Fair.
But it's tiring. I'll say that from a content creation point of view, from an editorial point of view, it's quite tiring because that means every article you are implementing that type of thinking.
I get it. But from the time you started writing all the way to now, it's been like, what, 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years.
Landscape has changed, right? Maybe when I first started, there's not a lot of content, you know, a few people kind of dominate the online space. Correct. But today it's like all sorts of mediums, everyone, you know, everything, right? So how has that changed in terms of like the experience for the consumer?
Yeah, you're right, Reggie. So like in the past, when we first started 2012 and we were not even doing it full time, that was just a passion project the first 3 years,
right? Sounds like most of the blogs at that period of time.
It is, right? It was starting from a place where there's very little financial content that maybe unless you're talking about mainstream media or overseas website, which like Investopedia, Business Insider back then, which have good content, but maybe not localized to Singaporeans, right? So back then that was the challenge. And that's when we started as well. And we try to take a very consumer-friendly approach because even if you look at sites like or media like BT or Wall Street Journal, it's very targeted towards people in the financial space or business leaders, not really the average person in Singapore that has to make a financial decision still. So that's how we started Laws and Sense. And back then, in general, you're right? There's a lot less sites. The blogs, there are financial bloggers, but they tend to be smaller, less mainstream, definitely very little or no advertising dollars at that point in time. So don't even talk about trying to get
make
a sponsored
a thing.
Post.
Yes.
Sponsored posts don't understand, at that point in time, right? Today, the problem is that there's too much information. In the past, it used to be financial blogs or media companies that will create content. Mm. Nowadays, every single financial institution want to create their own content.
Yes.
To me, the idea being that there is a value to the SEO when people search on a certain topic, they land on your website. And then from there, you obviously can surface your products or your services. Mm. So every site wants to do that. Nothing wrong. It's a content marketing play, right? So then the question becomes, so many websites, who do I read?
Yeah.
Right.
Who do I trust?
The consumer goes from a point of view 10 years ago where not enough sites creating content to now there's too many, who do I read? So that's the challenge, right? That I think a lot of consumer, and I think what we typically do is we just go to the trusted platforms or generally the ones we feel we can trust better. And then of course you cross-reference, right? You don't just read one review, you cross-reference. But I would say that the more trusted platforms still have an edge. In the finance space, when I look at content sites or rather news sites, right? If I want to get a little bit more insights, I go to places like Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, right? Not that they are totally unbiased, but sometimes have very strong views that you disagree with also.
You mean like against China?
US media, right.
So I don't trust them on that
ground. I wouldn't say I don't trust them, but at end of the day, they are US media sites.
Yeah, bias on that ground.
So let's just leave it as that, right? They are US media sites. I think as savvy readers, we should always be aware of these things. They are US media sites. I'm not saying they are biased. I read them as well.
I think when I read Al Jazeera, when they are not talking about the Middle East.
All right. That's a logical way to think about this.
I read France 24.
Because they have no reason to be biased.
Because they have the whole issue with Qatar and Saudi and all that, right? So, but they have a decent coverage on like other parts of the world, right? So generally, like if you read RT, which is a Russian news site, right? Then you question their views on like the US, right? So similar, when you read all the US financial news site, then you got to question their worldview on how they look at China and other parts of the world.
Certain topics, they may have no reason to be biased also, right? So maybe politics, you might feel that sensing. But I think if you ask me about the financial markets and things like that, typically they have no strong incentives to be biased in, besides maybe the fact that, the information is just there and that's how they interpret it. Right? But if you talk about political news, maybe there is some incentives there.
So as a person born into an age where there's all this information out there, everybody is putting out narratives, trying to drive certain ideas, specifically in the financial world, and then sometimes it gets very heated, right? I mean, you see the forums, very heated, right? So how do I then come in as an individual to then discern all this information, say, which one should I listen to?
So that's a sensitive question, right? If you have a bank or a robo-advisor, right? And then they write a content about certain things, right? The logical plugin that they will have is that they will want to say, okay, this is the problem you have with investing. Here's how my platform can help you, right? As a consumer, I mean, if you are somewhat savvy, you will just know that that's just how they are doing it, lah, right? It's content marketing for them. Nothing wrong. They're just doing the marketing work that they should be doing. But would you truly say that they are independent? I think even they themselves will say they're not independent, right? There's no debate there. Does it mean the information is bad? No. I think it can still be very valuable, but you want to take it with a pinch of salt, lah, knowing that the implicit biasness that they likely would have. Using robo-advisors as an example, right? It's going to be very likely that more or less they would always talk about having that diversified portfolio and making sure you invest long term.
That's their main offering.
And that's logical as well, right? So if you want to hear their insights on that, they might even be an expert on those kind of things.
They've come on our show a few times.
Correct.
So,
but then if you talk about, would they ever say that you should invest in individual stocks, trade the markets? Probably not. And rightly so, because they probably wouldn't want to get into a conversation that's nothing to do with them. I think the line maybe you drawn a little bit is when one party trashes the other way of investing just because that's not really
what they offer.
Because I think in general, not 100%, but most financial instruments, I call it somewhat neutral. So even you look at something like options, some people will say option trading is very risky. You should steer away from it, right? But actually, the early days when options or call or put options or future contracts are being developed, it's actually meant to de-risk.
Yes.
The farmer who is growing his rice or corn, right? It's so that he has that price certainty next year when his crops are harvested, that he knows what the market will pay him versus at that point in time, oversupply. So even products that are like derivative products or like option products, they are neutral. It's how we use it that makes it speculative.
That's what
I would say.
What about ILPs?
ILPs.
Because it's like super heated, right?
Yes.
Like it's very hot online, all the forums, you know, both sides fight each other.
I have written an article just slamming ILPs years ago, right? And back then, the product construct to me was not efficient for someone who is potentially trying to invest and grow his money, right? But there's so many flip side of the coin, right? So to me, if you want to invest and grow your money, there are better solutions out there that you can consider, even at that point in time. Now, of course, there's even more, right? Someone else can say, hey, you should look at it maybe from an insurance coverage point of view. The truth is that ILP itself, there is so many different versions of it, right?
Yes.
In general, the product can be quite complex.
Mm.
I think it's fair to say, and I think even financial advisors will agree with me, it's very hard for a consumer to choose or discern it on their own without someone advising them. Because
it's
of
a very complex model.
Because of the technicality
yes,
of the product,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Again, not a generalized thing. Some products might be a bit more simple. But in essence, I think when you buy an ILP, you definitely need the advice of a financial advisor.
Mm.
Even just, for example, from an investment point of view, where to put your money. And I think the products, and rightly so, the insurance themselves have also evolved their products over time.
Yes.
Right. So in today's context of the ILP product, I would say that I'm not super familiar with how it's being offered, but there's a lot of technical details that's being put in such that you probably need an advisor to do it. That's it. I don't get an ILP.
So for me,
as an individual level, I use insurance for protection for myself, my family, and then I invest separately. I try to keep it separate.
I get what you're saying, because actually with insurance investments paired together, man, actually the modeling is very complicated. The amount of things that you got to model into the clarity is quite hard.
I think you can even simplify it a bit further, right? Which is that if my insurance coverage is vital to me, I want to be able to hold on to my insurance coverage regardless of what my investment portfolio is doing.
Mm.
So I don't want a situation where I decided not to invest, hence I lose my insurance coverage as well, right? So vice versa, right? You know, if I want to invest, I can invest independently.
Mm.
My insurance coverage is a separate problem that I should take care of separately.
Yeah.
So that's how I see it. And maybe that's not exactly great for like financial advisor, especially if they're trying to push these products, when people like us say these things. But I also have a little bit of an afterthought after so many years, right? Which is that, so one of the things that we were very strong at when we first started or very passionate in was about the financial advisory space and how there's maybe a lot of conflict of interest, some form of mis-selling. I started having the idea of dollars and cents actually during the global financial crisis.
Mm.
So I was in army back then, 2009. And then a lot of GFC stuff, you know, all the mini bonds, Lehman crisis. I was just reading up and then how retirees lose their money to products that they thought were safe. Safe products, 4-5% return, not out of the blue, should be quite safe. Securitization, then they realized that, you know, they lost money. So that got my interest. And then when you start to deep dive, you realize, hey, there's so much conflict of interest with a lot of like commission based, not just the insurance companies, right? The banks as well, right? The bankers, they are remunerated on a commission base. They try to push sales. And that got my interest in finance. In the early days, we were very passionate about speaking out against this kind of conflict of interest thing. And then after a while, we realized that sometimes when you are too passionate about something, it's counterintuitive. Why? Because at the end of the day, insurance is still important. But what if you have a very strong media trying to make all insurance people seem like, oh, they are just out there to con your money, get you to pay for things you don't need, right? Then what you have is that opposite effect where your readers that are reading your sites and trust your content, they start to have you to be super skeptical about insurance to the point that maybe it's counterproductive for them, right? You know, you have a kid, you should buy insurance, but you think, no, insurance waste money, man. Right? So then I realized that, hey, we have to be more balanced in our views, right? Otherwise, the people, the readers we try to help, it may actually work against them if we put a very strong opinion against something that they might have needed.
What about sponsored posts? Right? Because when advertisers come to us, say they want to do something, they put money,
they want their results,
and they want things to be said a certain way. So how then, as a consumer of content, you know, like how do you kind of
manage? I think there is a few things to, I think I can say from a publisher point of view, right? It's sponsored posts is one of those topics that, I mean, at the end of the day, we look at the media space. Most media companies, they make money two ways, right? Either the subscriber pay or the advertisers pay. And actually, for most media companies, including your mainstream medias, is both. right?
Mix, yes.
You pay for a subscription and you still see ads as well. I think from a consumer point of view, we just have to understand how the media business works, lah. That advertising is what drives most. In fact, it's typically not the subscription fee.
Even
for media publishers that charge you for a premium paywall or stuff, subscription fee is likely just a small percentage of their overall revenue. Mm. It's the advertising
unless
dollars.
Unless you're New York Times, lah.
No, lah.
If you look at New York Times financial, I think it's about 50-50 at this point.
Oh, it's 50-50, yeah. I mean, they are the most successful subscriber-based model. Yeah. And I mean, the Times is one of those where, you know, people wouldn't mind paying for, I think. But I think for most of us media sites, it is quite hard to expect.
Very hard,
yeah, and even, I mean, look at the Times, right? I think it's, they're hitting like 10 mil type of numbers, which is great for them, but I mean, comparatively to the world, it's really just a small percentage still, right? So that really tells you the number of people who are willing to pay for content, right? And for the rest of us who don't have a paywall or don't intend to put a paywall, it's the advertising dollars, right? Yeah. It goes without saying, right?
Yeah.
So then the question comes from a publisher point of view, right?
How can I trust you when you're sponsored posts?
A few things, right? So I think the first thing is that as a publisher, you have to take on sponsors that make sense for you. Right. If you are stock investing heavy website, then suddenly you have a robo advisor come to you. It's not within your company's, publisher's ethos to actually, it's different. It's a differing view already, right?
Mm.
And those are the ones that I think, money aside, you know, I think publishers or bloggers should think twice, about taking it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it is very time consuming, not easy to manage advertisers' expectations, especially when you try to infuse editorial or advertorial, if it's an advertorial, right? So they will want you to write in a certain way, right? But do note, they also want the performance to be good.
Yeah.
So readers are not stupid at all, right? If it's a sponsored post, and I mean, you should declare it, we declare it, most publishers declare it, people will know it's a sponsored post. And then if the content is just whatever the advertisers want to say, then, you know, chances are it's not going to fly well, right? Which goes without saying, right? And advertisers may want all their messaging to be in there, but they also want the performance to be good. So how do you balance the two? The fact is that if you can think of it as it is consistent, it goes in the same direction, right? If you can produce a good piece of work that your readers would want to read, even though it's a branded content, that is typically something that is a win for the advertisers. But sometimes they don't see it that way because they want their marketing message to be in there. So that's the biggest challenge. It's to be honest, quite time consuming. It requires a lot of content strategizing on our end where they might tell us, hey, they want this to be written in a certain way. And we say, no, that doesn't work. You try not to tell the advertisers straight in the face, but basically you're telling them you'll fall flat. Right? And then when it falls flat,
I'm vibing.
And then when it falls flat, you will
come
back to me.
And then they come and tell you, you're not effective. It's like, bro, you force feed me some of these messages.
So it's tiring. You do need, you know, people to manage the advertisers. A lot of times after you work with them a while, they trust you.
Yes, that's the best type of advertisers.
They trust you to produce content in a way that will be relatable to your readers, that will be valuable to your readers.
And also valuable to them.
And within their messaging, right? So I have quite a few clients like that over the years. It's great to work with them. The results typically show readers get a lot of benefits because actually my co-founder Dinesh once said this, right? Are you better off reading a clickbaitish article that is written hazardly or a well-researched, properly curated sponsored post that, you know, we have to clear compliance, we have to make sure all the facts are correct, and we also want to make sure that you benefit from reading, right? And typically for sponsored articles, all of us know, it takes a lot more time, a lot more research to produce that piece versus an organic article that if you want to return and publish the next day,
you can wing it.
Yeah. So often the sponsored content can actually be more valuable than the organic because there's so much more effort that needs to be put in. If it's aligned to what the website typically will write about, then it's okay. I think the problem comes when bloggers, not necessarily financial bloggers, you see a lot of lifestyle sites also, they take on financial products.
来讲.
No names available. Because the truth is that the money is there, right? The banks, the insurance companies, the fintech firms, they have the most amount of advertising dollars to spend, right?
CPM is high.
So once they max out the financial sites, you know, they want new target audience, they go to the lifestyle sites. And that's where it looks awkward sometimes, right? When you have a social news site that suddenly starts producing financial content, then it's obviously a sponsored post, everyone knows, right?
They read off script one.
If in a lot of the setups, they may not have someone who is very financially knowledgeable anyway, right? So what are they going to say if there is a CFD platform provider that wants to advertise.
Hey, what CFD platform?
I mean,
very
casually. I mean, just a technical thing, right? What's the writer going to really say, right?
So it ends up with features, law, fees, law, rewards, or pretty much always ends up with those few things.
I mean, I wouldn't say like we don't take other kind of content as well. So like, for example, I was just thinking about some of the non-finance clients we take in, right? So two comes to mind from a long time ago, both food related, right? So one was with Tiger Beer. This was many years ago. So Tiger Beer had this, I love this campaign, right? So for Tiger Beer, I really like it still sticks to me, right? The advertising campaign was about street food. So they wanted to basically showcase the street food culture in Singapore. And then obviously you can drink your Tiger Beer with the street food,
which is what
happens in the coffee shop, right? So they approached us, when they approached us, we were like, oh wow, you know, we never take a F&B brand before, right? So, but then in the end, we try to put a bit of a financial angle, which did very well. So the article I still remember writing was like cost of running a hawker in Singapore. So we found our own hawker profile. We interviewed him. Everything was organic because the information we get was clearly just from the people we interview. And then roughly how much it took him to start his hawker store without going into details, because we don't want to be too specific. And it's just part of the campaign. And the article did really well, right? So sometimes if you put a little bit more creativity, you ask yourself, where does dollars and cents stand in? Or where does your financial side stand in on this conversation? Then you can think, cost of running a hawker, I think it's a topic that Singaporeans are generally interested to know. You know,
my database tell me yes, people care about it.
So, and then there's a money angle as well, right? So, you know, when it sits on our website, it's not completely weird. You know, we're not trying to review the bak chor mee taste or anything like that, right? We're just doing what makes sense for us. And I think that's what sometimes get overlooked when it comes to content creation. I think, you know, just trying to put an angle to these kind of topics.
Fair. But then when the sponsors come in, right? And they try to weave certain angles into your stuff, right? And they try to put out certain messaging. I get you're talking about the process. It's very difficult. I get the clear L&C is very tao tian. It's one of the worst shit ever, okay? But sorry, L&C. Not so I'll tell you, but yeah, they're doing their job, you know, but it's a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But from a consumer standpoint, right? Like, how do they then know that this is holistic in the view of this is how I should look at a piece of content?
Okay, in general, when it's a financial product, we want to make sure that it's MAS regulated. So the company should be MAS regulated. And if there isn't, there must be a specific reason why. Maybe they're just not a financial client in the first place, right? So MAS do have very strict regulations on who is regulated, right? So that's the first check that I think all of us should do, you know, when we talk about financial advertiser. I think secondly, it's important to understand the product so that you know how to explain it in a way that people can understand the pros and the cons. So whoever the editorial, the writer is, needs to understand these products well so that they can highlight disadvantages of the product if need be, right? I personally feel like based on our experience, most of the clients get that actually. Because if you're MAS regulated and you're in the finance space, right, compliance is going to be quite strict as well.
Yes, compliance is serious.
Even if you want to say all the good things about it, they may not be able to allow you to say anyway, right? So most clients that are MAS regulated, they do get it. And I think that is something which helps. That said, we do reject clients. We do take down posts or drafts after they have been sent, because of differences that we can't agree with the client sometimes. But usually we try to keep that as little as possible, especially once work has started. So a lot of the due diligence on our end will start before we even sometimes reply the first email, right? And I think we are quite fortunate because we've been around for a long time. So most of our clients are generally bigger and more established FIs, like financial institutions. So they themselves have their credibility to protect as well. So I think that is something that helps us. I do sometimes see smaller financial blogs. Maybe they are more receptive to smaller advertisers, less established companies. So that one is a little bit riskier, need to do more due diligence. And we do. Sometimes we see companies, hey, where's these companies from? Do a lot of fact finding before we even reply them. You know, sometimes, you know, you try not to reply them, you know.
I know.
You guys probably get it a lot as well.
I get a lot of these methods.
But knowing what your site should be doing and what it shouldn't be doing is something that's very, very important. It's actually even harder for us, right? Because we don't just do it full-time with a team of writers and the setup is full-time, right? So to look at advertising dollars, it's bread and butter, right? Otherwise, you can't do it. Obviously, right? But we have a strong process for that. Yeah. It's not that easy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, okay. So what is something that you put out that didn't age so well?
I would say some of the early days insurance articles that I wrote could have been a little bit too harsh on the industry, I would say. I wouldn't regret anything I write, but I think that, you know, in general, it was a little bit, we could have been more balanced in our view, not just heat up against the insurance industry in the early days, and instead put in more effort towards educating people about insurance.
So how has it evolved?
So if you think about it, you don't like a topic, right? They say insurance, you don't like how it's happening. You can either spend your effort and your energy complaining, writing, you know, suggesting what's wrong with all this way of doing the advisory, or you can put in your effort towards explaining what consumers should think about when they approach a financial advisor, right? Which is actually closer to what we ourselves would do also.
Yeah.
Right? You would likely talk to a financial advisor. What you actually need as a consumer is to be savvy enough such that if you happen to meet an advisor or the advisor tries to sell you something that you don't really need, you ask the right questions and then make sure you don't get products you don't need, or even just stay away from the guy if you think that, you know, he doesn't have your best interest at heart, right? So I think that is, you know, you're saying what didn't age so well. I think the early days being super harsh on the insurance industries maybe did no one any favor, you know, and what we could have done, what we are doing now is more sort of educating people about the importance of insurance and what they should think about. And maybe it comes with age as well, right? So like now, you know, I'm married with 3 kids, you know, insurance protection is something that's very, very vital, right? Because anything happens to me or my wife, you know, the kids, someone needs to care for them. And it's not just physical, it's financial as well, right? So you start thinking about all these things and then you realize that, hey, you know, I'm probably a good ambassador for the insurance industry now because I'm one of those guys who call my insurance agent before my kid comes out saying, bro, we need to get some advice, plan some critical illness as soon as possible. Please help me advise what are the products we can get and then let's fill in the paperwork, right? That's what I advocate, right? Parents should talk to their advisors as soon as their kid is coming out.
Because before the kid comes out, then essentially there's a whole period where there's no data to evaluate your kid uniquely. So then the risk profile is neutral?
Yeah, no, actually...
It's not just a
bad time. Okay, so actually a lot of insurers, most of the products like the Shield plan, typically there's a waiting period of about 30 days, right? So if there is a problem during the first few weeks, you don't get covered lah. It's only after 30 days then they will accept. I think it's around 30 days or so. But the idea is that you want to get it as soon as possible, right? Because even after 30 days, no, I mean, these kids can go into the hospital quite easily. And if they accidentally get a virus, the doctor not sure why, 2 months old, straight away hospitalized already, right? Because everybody wants to play safe in Singapore. So these kind of things can cost you money. So you should get it as soon as possible. And the worst thing is that if that do happen and you haven't got the insurance, and even after your kid comes out, you know, the insurer is going to ask you questions.
So exactly the whole when you have
on
a neutral ground, you actually get, in some ways, the best value. But once data comes in, the differential of your kid, you know, all that things, then it all gets factored into the premium.
And I mean, these are the kind of education that, you know, we try to do these days. You know, like I say, you know, we try to move away from just saying what's wrong with the industry, try to focus on how we can help people as well, right? So this kind of education piece, which is like, hey guys, you know, you want to throw a first month birthday for your kid, don't forget to get an insurance policy at the same time. You know, these are good messaging that helps people. And then, you know, sometimes they ask you what do you buy. And so a simple Shield plan for a start, you know, would at least cover any hospital bills that comes in in the off chance that, you know, sick and then have to be hospitalized. Because I have that experience as well. My first kid was, I think it was like 4 months or so. So typical, you know, fall ill, then there was an incident, then quickly sent her to hospital. Doctor didn't know why. Hospitalized for like, I think 2 or 3 days. Well, it's like 1,005, you know. Just like that. Public hospital. Luckily, you already bought the insurance so that at least it's covered. You don't have to pay anything.
Fair point.
What do you think? Like,
yeah. I come from a view that...
challenge the status quo or focus on educating?
I come from a view that you cannot blame the seller because they are inherently incentivized to sell, right? But you need to focus on educating the buyer, right?
Yes.
So that's my worldview. As much as possible, I always try to break down the concepts, their selling process. Why are certain things done like this? Why they can throw money out there because your LTV is much higher than their CAC, you know, a lot of these kind of things, like how is the product created? What are the layers within it? So, I mean, on my show, or at least on my personal segment, it's mostly all of these kind of stuff, right? Because I don't think you can blame the seller for selling because they are inherently incentivized to sell.
I think the product, it's on its own, it's neither good or bad, if you get what I mean, right? No financial institution comes out with a product.
Everybody wants to sell the product.
Yeah. The selling
your product, Chui, right, is also very hard to sell. But in the financial world, I think at this point in time, we all realize that a lot of the products are intentionally make it a little bit difficult to compare relative, right? So if, let's say, there are like 6 factors that you compare across the board for a particular policy or for a particular tool, then everybody kind of match each other, and then you're not here a little bit higher, there a little bit lower. You know, so it makes it, they try to stand, they engineer products to try to stand out and be a little bit different from other people. It's very hard to compare apples for apples on those grounds.
I think I have a thought process here, and it's quite linked to fintech as well, which is that if your product is thriving because consumers are poorly informed, then you have a problem. Because that, in other words, that means you are profiting because people are unaware. But if your product is a product that will do even better as consumers become more financially savvy, more educated, then chances are you have a good product. Because that means that as people become more knowledgeable, they want your product.
And truth is, those guys don't advertise. Most of the people that create those kind of products, they don't advertise one.
So you feel...
I've met many of them. There's always more well advertised. Money just flows, right? And I will not name the products here, but the reality is because they are best in class, you know, whether it's a broker, whether it's a fund, whether it's a trust, they don't need to advertise.
I don't completely agree.
For people that know...
I don't completely agree, you know, because I think there are many good products out there that just people just don't know because there's not enough information, not enough marketing or advertising around it.
Yeah, I agree with that as a point, you know, but from my view of the situation, a lot of these products, they are very good. They are not throwing money at advertisers. Like, I'm not receiving their calls, and I ask around, say, hey, no, they don't really sponsor a lot. So, like, oh, okay.
They don't need to.
They're best in class, right?
I think what we can agree on is that, you know, if a financial institution has a product that as more people are financially more savvy, they start to use it less, then that company has a problem. That means you are, I say, benefiting because your customers are not aware.
Right? But that's not to say everybody that advertises is lousy product. But it's really...
So for companies that are confident that as long as the readers or the consumers are more educated, they will want their product. I think those guys are the ones that we will want to work with. We don't want to work with the guys who are trying to keep things hush-hush, not transparent, because they are afraid that once they are transparent, people will not even want their product anymore. I think those are the, maybe sometimes there's legacy issues also with some of the things. I'm just going to say it out, like brokerage platforms, right? You have $25 transaction fee, you have $1 transaction fees, savvy consumers.
No dollar transaction fee, guys don't advertise, you don't need me to say who.
Mostly, I think the more savvy, I mean, if you want to invest $500 a month DCA, you know, how can you pay $25 as a transaction fee, right? That's 5% of your capital.
No, because sometimes when they come as advertisers, I'll be like, can you improve your product first? It's very hard
tough.
For me to spin.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough, right? And sometimes there are more to meet the eye. Sometimes the product in its own, there are also certain factors that people don't know.
Of course.
But, you know, you look at a consumer, if he just wants to invest $100, $200 a month DCA, then how is he going to pay $25 commission fee, right? So I think those are the challenging questions.
But in finance, naturally, when there's a need for the product, there will be someone that comes to create a product and kind of fill it up, right? So I think there's the kind of market dynamics that exists. But the bigger issue is always when certain messaging are being force-fed. And certain things are sold in a certain way. But after that, the consumer will be like, hey, actually, like, not matching my original plan.
A part of my job on a somewhat regular basis is getting a lot of brief, usually from, I don't want to say client, like, they don't like, the agencies, client, agencies, right? And then the agency person who always sometimes feels like, you know, this is maybe the first or second financial brand they ever handled.
for their agency.
Okay, okay, I'm vibing here.
Yeah,
I'm vibing here.
You know, right?
And I feel like I'm educating them more than they
Because you look at a typical marketing agency, a smaller ones, right? They are likely that they don't have many financial clients, right? So probably a lot of smaller lifestyle brand, one or two financial clients, which is very, very important for them. They give you a brief and then they try to tell you about, hey, this is the USP of maybe this platform.
So, bro, this is not USP. Everybody use the same shit.
Yeah, and then... Correct. PR agency, one thing, right? Marketing. Let's talk about sponsored content. They want to pay you money, right? And then they tell you this is the brief, this is the USP, right? And then you look at it and like, oh my goodness, this is not really a USP, right? If we write about it, a savvy consumer is just going to say that
it's like, bro,
there's nothing in there, you can get something cheaper elsewhere, right? And then sometimes like, when you say like maybe a product design is the wrong thing, sometimes also it's because the agency themselves pick up the wrong USP.
Yeah,
right. And sometimes when you talk to the client directly and you tell them this is the sentiments of people, you know, if you want to target, if you want to focus on this USP, you may even get backlash.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Which is something that nobody wants.
Yes.
As a publisher, you don't want the backlash. As a brand, you don't want the backlash. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's typically, we just tell them, hey, I'm just telling you, we don't want to get into trouble. You don't want to get into trouble. This is not a USP. You have to focus on something that's actually different. Right? And there are clients that will listen to you, which is great, right? And then, of course, there are clients that don't want to listen to you.
Yeah.
And usually those just don't pan out well.
Yeah, they don't pan out well, yeah. Actually, some of the most exciting projects are the ones where you know the products are best in class.
Yeah.
And then they're still willing to throw marketing dollars. Right? Well, that is very easy to push, in my view.
Is that really hard? I mean, I just want to weigh in here, right? It's very, really, very difficult for anyone to specifically be clearly the best in class.
Yeah, because actually, there are some features. So I think that's when...
To be a clear-cut best in class is hard.
Yeah, it's hard. So usually there are certain features that are better than others, right? And I think that's where the USP is very clear, right? You try to highlight the USP and also kind of define what kind of audience or what depending on who, what their goals are, you know, it works best for them, right? Serves their needs. And I think that's the fundamental of choosing any tool, right? Or even reading content. You must know like what do you really want? What is your incentive structure? What are your goals? Because that then fundamentally affects your choices.
I just want to do a plug in here actually, right? So one of the companies that I really like the way they do content marketing is Endowus. I give you an example, right? So everybody know of trailer fees right now, right? Which is the amount that the fund manager sometimes give back to the advisor who sells it, right? But Endowus is the first company that built its business model around rebating that trailer fee. And then they did a lot of education around what it is. Mm. So in that sense, you know, the content marketing to me was done right. Because what they're doing is that they were educating a lot of Singapore investors, both young and old, about something that a lot of investors didn't know about. And then it also happens to serve what their purpose is and their marketing message well. Mm. So I think those are where it's really well integrated, where you have your content marketing focus is on something that it's very relatable to what your brand wants to do, right? Mm. And
not sponsored. Not sponsored.
I mean, they sometimes do sponsor or sometimes they write it on their own. So I think those are really just, again, not trying to say the product is great. I'm just saying that the messaging that they do is very in tune to what their brand wants to advocate.
Fair. So then in your whole 10 years of writing and all that, right? Like your goals definitely also develop over time, right?
As an individual,
your goals develop over time. So what are some of these things that you put out, some of this content that you put out that age very well as your goals kind of develop?
I think the whole idea, and more so than ever, right, I realized that financial decisions, when we make them early in our life, can really give us a lot of value in the long term. So stuff that age very well on, for me personally, emergency savings. Right. So when I was younger and this was before I was married, before we have kids.
Everything invest.
No. We make it a point to save. You have to be a diligent saver when you're young.
Great.
So misconception number one, right? When my salary becomes higher, I can save more compared to when I start working, my salary not so high. So how much can I save? Misconception. Why? Because you will hit stages in life where you can no longer save even if you want to. For example, you got your kids, you got your house, you got your parents who need your support. And then at that point in time, sure, your salary may have risen double from the first day you started working. but your costs, your essential costs may go up triple, four times, right? And you can't afford not to spend, right? For example, healthcare, do you want to not afford to spend? You know, very hard for us to budget this kind of thing. Each time you need to go hospital, A&E, $150, you know, which parent would, if they can afford it, say, no, no, I'm going to not go today. Hard, right? And these things multiply as you have multiple kids as well. So,
guy has three kids, really.
So start saving early. I think that's very important. When I started saving early, it also helped me when I actually wanted to do dollars and cents full time, because I had a little bit more financial security, knowing that, you know, even if we can't make money for the first year, I'm still okay because I have my emergency savings to fall back on. Right. Thankfully, I didn't have to tap on it too much because we were able to generate revenue once we went full time, because we already started on a sideline for a few years already. So emergency saving is something really very important. Starting your investment journey earlier, I think those are super vital topics. What else have aged well? Diversified portfolio, which I think everyone says.
No, but back then it wasn't hit. Back then it was very indie.
Yes.
Right? And then now it's like mainstream. So, yeah.
I think you can't blame the us of last time or the people in the past.
No, because it aged well.
Yeah, because in the past, very hard. In the past, it's very hard to get a diversified portfolio. You don't have your robo-advisors. Your ETFs are limited in Singapore, right? So those days are quite hard, but it is really true, right? Another one which has gone under the radar until recently, fixed income, right? So in the last 5 years, everybody equity. You see what happened this year, right? You know, everyone with high risk, you know, and then the whole risk tolerance, don't invest too much if you're not willing to take on that risk. You know, this year you really see that difference already. So in some sense, I'm glad that some of this HO advice has panned out well, but unfortunately it has to come at the cost of like a market downturn for people to really see. Then now you see the opposite effect, everybody charging for the bonds. SSB, treasury bills, everyone all demanding it, right? So you can see how investors think also, right? When everyone wants to invest in stocks, everyone chong for stocks, the price goes up, people chong some more. Then now, because of the recession, because of interest rate hike, naturally, people are more interested in bonds because bonds got high interest rate. But then when it's chong, it's everyone all chong into that one, right? So this kind of things, no financial advice here, but sometimes, you know, you have to observe how people think about the investment space. Sometimes I wish people are able to think of their investment journey independently of what other people are doing.
Tell me. Because on some level, as content houses, we are pushing certain ideas.
We write what we think people are interested in, right?
And okay, so there's that part.
Yeah.
You know, but also there are certain parts like you've established that, you know, you guys at this point in time, the whole editorial team is very into the property space. So you write generally a little bit more, right? So then as a big publishing, or at least a relatively big publishing house, then you perfume the space with a certain angle, right? And even on our end, we also talk, you know, some ideas that we are like more into. So we also talk about some of these things.
All the trends that are interesting.
So there are some of these ideas, right? So what do you mean by like you hope that people could do it independently? Because it's very hard.
So that's the thing, right? We are all in the media space, right? So people read, people consume the content that they're interested in, that is what people write about, right? But here's the thing, right? It's like, think of it as, let's use an example of the food industry, right? Good food, quality food in Singapore is all around us, right? But then when you see sometimes a food blog suddenly cover this, you know, very good nasi padang somewhere.
Usually the third one.
The next day, there will be a huge queue, and the queue might easily last for 1 week, 2 weeks, sometimes 1 month, right? Until the next trend comes, right? And so what happens is that if you are following the food site, you are just basically queuing up all the time. Because everywhere you want to go, it goes viral, you read, then you queue up. And then maybe when you queue up, the food quality suffer.
Yes.
The guy is selling in volumes, your experience dwindle, right?
Yes.
And for you to actually get the best experience yourself, what you need to do is, if you really like to eat, you know, you go and find yourself, right? Don't just rely on what the food blog says, right? I mean, that's a quite common sense thing. You can rely. Use it to get information, but don't always rely.
I know.
Right? And it's the same thing with investing, right?
Yeah.
You can read the media space, you can read what we are writing, what you are discussing about, what other sites are writing, or even the video content, right? But as an investor, if you want to be successful in the long term, or want to have a higher chance of being successful, you also have to do some independent form of research. Yeah.
No, man, I did a piece around this idea of like why ETFs that follow hype fails, right? Or like why hype ETFs fail, or why certain new theme funds tend to fail, because they are formed out of a hype. Because a lot of people are interested in this thing. I think in the recent decade, it was like green tech lah, or like EVs lah, or like cannabis lah. You know, some of these big trends, you know, that developed into ETFs, right? Because there was so much trends, so underlying stocks were flying up, and then all these fund houses decided, oh, hey, a lot of people want this thing. Let us create a fund. And then they launch as ETF. And when the ETF is launched, they're buying all these underlying stocks, you know, peak prices. And then you come in because you follow the hype, you buy up the ETFs, and then eventually,
I was just saying here, which is that it may not be that the trend is wrong per se. But what is likely is that you are paying a higher price.
Yes.
So the money is going into the space.
Exactly. So it's not that the trend
is still off. You may still be right.
Yeah, but 50 years later. You may be paying a higher price. Yes.
The problem comes when, and this is what is a better litmus test of what is a good company, is when the hype is gone. How are they performing?
Yeah. Yes. So my observation over the decade, or maybe 8 years or 8 years of investing, is that there will be a hype, and then all these ETFs or whatever will form, and then a lot of people enter. After that, the thing will come down. It may not crash, but it will cool off.
And then you see the downturn. Yes, surviving?
Yes. So and that downturn, but a lot of people, you know, will fall off during that downturn, and then after that, that is when the space become interesting to look at it. You know, not in the early days. If you write that, because I'm following the narrative of you say like, oh, there's a blog they publish and everybody got a queue at Makan, right? You're going to be stuck at the queue all the time.
So back to the food analogy, the food might still be good though.
Yes. So it's not that the food is not good, but you're always stuck on the queue, right? Sometimes it will sell out, blah, blah, blah.
But I think, if you talk about food again, a nice distraction there, right? But like, you know, sometimes people do purposely just queue up at where the longest queue is because the perception is that if the queue is long, it must be good. Right?
Yeah, fair.
So to some extent, there's some element of truth in there.
Yeah. on some level. But I think when it comes to investing, you know, the hype is quite a problem, you know, for a lot of investors.
That's a funny story, right? Sometimes, you know, you've seen that same shop in near your neighborhood for many years. You never really try. Then one day, some food blog cover it, and then you see 30 people in the queue. Then suddenly you have a tendency, hey, maybe I should check it out too, right? Even though that place was always there for the last 10 years. I guess that's what I mean. If you do your own research, then you will know.
But
that said, you know, the stock market is also sometimes somewhat a popularity contest in the short term,
especially. So you might buy a good company
that you think that is good, and then the next 5 years, price
it's
never moves.
Shit show, yes. Yeah. It's horrible.
And everything else you see going up.
My rule of thumb is generally I avoid the hype, right? When the hype dying down, then I will come and like look at it and say, hey, what's actually going on here, right? Why was there a hype? Is there something on, you know?
Is it still worth it?
Is there something to look at? So I'm the bargain hunter, right?
It's true.
So that's just for everybody. You have your own investing style. Just to plug an episode, you can go and check out one of the earlier episodes that I did, right? Why hype ETFs fail? Cool. In closing, is there any other things you want to add for, you know, reading, consuming content, and being a little bit like more rigorous in trying to discern information in this huge world of information?
I think when it comes to finance, like, you know, it's quite important for us to take it quite seriously, because small financial decisions, small financial habits you do when you're young can result in a huge return in the long term.
Everything compounds. Not just money. Yes.
Money, knowledge also compounds. Yes. The more habits, you know, the easier it is for you to understand the financial world better and to be able to differentiate between what is maybe valuable and what's just noise. I think right now in the financial media space, the digital space, right, a lot of people are more fixated towards short form content.
Audience, okay, like they all listen 30, 40, 50 minutes.
One hour,
it's very long already.
Yeah, too long.
Don't anyhow say it.
Just nice.
Please stay around.
It must be, I always say in Singapore, must finish within
25 minutes, 30 minutes.
Get to work, you know, from start to end, 30 minutes.
Optimal time. Yes. That's why I tell all the advertisers.
One journey, one train journey.
Yes, it is true.
All right. So long form content is still important, and articles is one way. I don't even think it's long form. I think of books.
No, I think articles are very short.
But it's long for a lot of people these days already, lah.
Oh, really?
And they don't really want to read a 1,500 words article.
Okay, fair.
Unfortunately, fair. Books, all of us, right, we mm-hmm. get our early days knowledge from books. You see the...
What's a book you recommend?
I read one up on Wall Street.
One up,
I won't say I recommend, but these are the ones that open your eyes up. Mm-hmm. Read Freakonomics. Freakonomics is great. Freakonomics, right? It's fun, you know, it tells you about how the world works. One up on Wall Street. So start by reading. I think reading is very important. Articles are great, but books are even better.
Pick old books.
You don't need to follow the advice. You don't need to follow or memorize it unless you are a true believer.
Yeah,
but it opens up your eyes on how people think about the financial markets, the financial market operate. What are ways that it could be manipulated, you know, in some sense when everyone, like what you say, everyone chong for the ETF, the price goes up.
Yes.
Right? Opens up your, even if you're the strategies you don't really remember or believe in, right? So all these things are very important. You need to discern because I think there's a lot of noise in the market. You need to discern between sites that are...
So how do you discern?
Some ways are quite easy. You look at the purpose of certain sites, right? Yeah, or content marketing sites, right? Some sites you are just... I mean, I'm just going to say, I mean, there are product comparison sites. They sometimes just write what they want is kind of for you to choose a product with them and stuff like that. So always know the purpose and the motive of a content site that you're reading. I think it's very important, including dollars and cents, including yourself as well, right? What is our purpose? You know, why are we doing this work, right? We are advertising driven, right? So you come to our site, you will see ads on the site, you will see some sponsored posts. You don't have to buy the products or anything, you know, it's just there. If you agree with the content, you want to check out more on your own, you should go. So never make a purchase decision just based on one article, you know, and you go to another, you know, comparison site, you know, you should know what their purpose is. You go to a product platform player, they have articles, you should know what their purpose is, right? And I think that's very important. I think it's quite common sense, wouldn't you say? But sometimes
I don't know many things. I think common sense, my team tell me not very common one. So I feel like we should
ask yourself what's the purpose of sites.
Yes,
you know, if it's a individual blog, the type of profile the person is in, right? It's a person same age as you, older, younger, all these things matters, right?
Because
you can't just take their advice and implement on your own if they have a different risk profile or different view than you are.
So understanding the context, I think, is still the basis of a lot of these things. Great, cool stuff. Maybe one last thing for the aspiring writers out there that want to write and one day, you know, compete with you.
All right. discourage them, man.
Just like how I discourage you, don't be a podcaster. Don't join. Okay, go do something
else. How much can you make in Singapore?
Small space.
Even you are the best, also you can't make much money. Jokes aside, I think we started writing because we were passionate about the topic. I think it's very, very important to be passionate in the topic that you're writing about. What I'm seeing these days is that financial influencers are starting to become a bit lucrative, right?
It is.
Right. Maybe not in Singapore yet, but definitely overseas.
Yeah.
So I definitely can see a trend because what happens in the US, sometimes it just takes a matter of time before it comes into Singapore.
It will almost come. You can foresee one. Yes.
Right. So if you look at the US, the TikTokers, the personalities, the KOLs there, right? A lot of them are gearing into financial trading, such topics. The idea is that because they know that the financial advertisers can pay money. CPM is the highest. And that's why people are producing content. But my thought that in Singapore, at least, you should really do what you are interested in because our market is small. So what works in the US, even if it comes to Singapore, you know, and you are very popular, it doesn't mean you will make a lot of money just doing, you know, something that you don't really like.
Yeah.
Right. So just do what you're passionate in. If it's writing, go ahead. It's not easy. I think Reggie can testify. From my advertising, chances are the cost of running a site like ours is quite high. I'm not sure if people realize it, but we probably run on at least our editorial cost, probably run at an operating cost that's definitely way higher than any bloggers or even some of the smaller media outlets, I'll say, right? So
it's very hard to hire in this space.
It's very hard to hire. It's not cheap to hire writers, right? So the operating cost is very, very high. And our advertising business model is not easy as well. Because readers are very unlikely to pay you unless you run a model where you are kind of like giving a lot of insights and recommendations, right?
Yeah. Those are very popular.
Because people will pay if they feel like paying you will make them more money.
Yeah.
But sites like ours, you
you can't really, there's no recommendation, right? Mm-hmm. It's just all the typical things you should be doing. Mm. You know, people won't pay for that kind of content. Yeah, yeah. So we got to be careful, lah, right? Yeah, and then you have to deal with the advertisers as well. They have all the one as a totally set of problems.
Different set of problems.
All together, right?
I don't hate you guys, by the way, just saying. Yeah. I just hope to educate you.
So hopefully this is enough to discourage competitors from our space.
Yeah, or you can learn from the Instagram, following the passion thing, remind me of this Instagram page called the Pandan Pig or something.
What does it
Pandan
do?
This guy is amazing. He just goes to all these, his IG page, I think Pandan Waffle Pig or Pandan Pig or whatever. This guy just goes to every single pandan waffle in Singapore, right? And then he has a very structured, texture, taste, color.
Passion,
everything. Then got like 1, 2, 3 star and there's a very serious rating
pandan
system.
Waffle,
yeah, pandan waffle pig. Let me go and find something. Oh, if you guys know, please drop
definitely
it in the comments section.
True passion.
Then
there.
Passion. Hey, he got like what? 8,000, 9,000 followers. A lot of passionate pandan waffle people, right? I was like, wow, this guy is amazing.
Oh,
wow,
that's
right?
Crazy.
So, if you are that guy, I DM you to ask you to come on the show, maybe you can actually come on the show, right? So it's like, I want to know how you're going to make money out of this, right?
Genuine passion there, man.
Genuine passion. And let's be clear, even if this doesn't become like your side hustle of writing or blogging or creating content, doesn't become your main thing, it could be a thing that adds up in your life.
And
right?
It's a valuable skill because a lot of people are looking for writers to join, financial writers to join their marketing comms team nowadays.
So maybe you don't want to compete with Tim, you can join him.
You can join?
Oh, recruitment, please drop here. Yes.
Yeah.
Email to
Timothy@nonsense.sg. It's definitely easier to join than to compete.
It does.
I would say.
Does.
If
yes,
you're
yes.
passionate in writing, join a team that shares in your passion.
Yes, yes, yes. We are endlessly recruiting. hello@thefinancialcoconut.com. I will see you on the other side, okay?
Join a team that's passionate rather than compete against them.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks,
Reggie. Thank you. Love it. Love it.
Stay tuned all the way after this quick note for our personal money question segment. Before that, I hope you've learned something useful today. Join our Telegram group, follow us on our socials, and check out thefinancialcoconut.com.
Okay, Tim, we have TFC's three money questions.
Right.
The first question is, what has been your best and worst investment you've ever made?
Okay, I'll give you one financial, one non-financial, right?
Okay, great.
So
best and worst.
The financial so far is I was very, very fortunate. I bought my BTO flat early. I was one of those...
You sure you don't get cancelled? No,
I mean, that was like 2011.
Okay,
that's more than 10 years
ago.
So I was very, very fortunate to buy my BTO flat early because it was, and just happened to also marry the same person later on, thankfully. So because BTO flats are really a lot more affordable, especially when you're young. So that is, I think, one of the best financial decisions, just purely from a monetary point of view. The non-financial one, and it sounds cliche, but it's really very important. I think I married my wife and I share very similar attitudes towards money. I think that's the number one thing that's one of the most important thing that helps with our finance plans, right? That we have the same attitude towards saving, we have the same attitude towards planning for the future. Obviously, when it comes from an investment point of view, I have a lot more opinions what to invest in. But in general, we have the same attitude towards money, and that helps both in terms of your financial plans as a family, as well as, in marriage as well. Because, I think financial disagreement can really cause a lot of stress, in a marriage.
And what's the worst investment?
I wouldn't say it's the worst thing because I thankfully haven't made a lot of mistakes in my investment journey. But I think I wish I started investing in overseas market when I was young, right? Because not an excuse.
Because
but,
there was a huge rally from 2011.
No, I think not an excuse, but really back in 2012, I think it's not so easy to invest overseas at that point. Lesser ETFs available, definitely no robo portfolios to consider, right? And the truth is that I probably invested too much in the Singapore market when I was young, which I still hold some of these positions because, the long-term some of these companies are still fine, which ironically in 2022 so far,
they are outperforming.
They are
everyone.
All performing, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess that geographical diversification point of view does hold weight, right? Because Singapore companies, especially the blue chips, have been quite resilient thus far. But yeah, I do wish I invested in overseas market much more earlier. But back then, I just didn't really put in enough effort to go search for alternatives. Yeah.
Back then, the effort was a lot
higher. More expensive.
Yes.
A lot more expensive.
Yes. Now it's much easier.
Now it's really
so it becomes
easy.
The talk of the town. Yeah, everyone is doing it. Yeah. Okay, next question. What is one thing under $100 that has become a game changer?
It's a bit of a cheating answer, but for me, it's more like I started subscribing to sports a lot more. So it's under $100 a month. Not like... not perpetual.
Okay.
Yeah, so what happened was like during the pandemic, actually it started during the pandemic, right? So during the pandemic was mental, I mean, you're all cabin fever, you do
work. Horrible, yes.
How many hours can you work at home, writing articles?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Even you need to rest, right?
You know, when the borders open, immediately I go.
You rest, right?
I cannot tahan, it's like cabin fever.
Yeah, so I actually started subscribing to a lot of sports at that point in time, which actually helped me decompress a lot better.
Like joint programs?
No, sports. So the UFC, NBA.
Okay. So like watch the show.
Watch the sports.
subscribe.
Never can't even go to the gym, that's the problem.
Fair.
Right, okay. So I think for everyone it's different, but I think we need to decompress and sometimes we just need something that's totally unrelated to our work and just enjoy it. And for me, it's like, okay, I used to tell my wife, you know, my way of decompressing, not too bad, go to the gym, run, carry some weights. Not so bad. It's free. It's healthy. Right. So during the pandemic, you can't do that. Right. Mm. So then sports, I subscribe. And I think that has been game changer for me.
I don't know
if anyone can relate to that.
No, you know why I'm laughing? No, you know, because the thing that I watch to like kind of tune out, right, is people cleaning the hoofs, you know, have you seen those videos where the guy cleaned the hooves, the horses, the donkeys, the cows? I was like, wow, very cool, very clean.
Definitely on your content algo.
Someday this thing appeared on my recommend. I clicked in and never stopped coming. Yeah. You know, but okay, when I'm not feeling it, then I will turn it off.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. One place you learn from that you think is underrated.
The one that I recently read that I really like is this book called Dollars and Cents. It tells you about the way people think about money. And I just bought it because I was like, hey, this similar name to the website.
Yeah,
but it's really good, you know.
Nice. And you have a column on the site that interviews all these people?
Oh yeah, we have a column on our business doors, it's a business site that interviews entrepreneurs. So we ask them questions. Sometimes the questions are very random, like what's your daily routine? And then what are some of your favorite books that have inspired you? And yeah, the books that so far I've seen the answers being given. Sometimes I make it a point to buy some of the books and they have been truly quite exceptional, really changed the way you think, or at least, you know, opens up your mind to stuff that, you know, you never really think about, both in terms of personal life as well as business world.
Nice. Check them out. Thank you. Thanks for all your time.
All right. Thanks, Reggie.
Love it. Bye. Take care, bro. Woo.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.